have you ever heard someone being sick referred to as lurgy?
Mm-hmm.
That was invented in the 50s by Spike Milligan.
Oh, really? Lurgy's from... Really?
Lurgy is the name of a fictional disease from an episode of The Goon Show he did with Peter Sellers. So Spike Milligan, Peter Sellers, and Harry Secombe.
Ah.
And it was one of the joke storylines revolved around these two scammers convincing the government there was a new disease called lurgy that they had to buy medicine for and that only they sold.
Man, oh, to have the cultural impact of something making TV when there were three TV shows.
Oh, man. Well, this was even on the radio on The Goon Show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, even yeah. then.
Even then.
Welcome to Goon Pod. This is a podcast which asks special guests to talk about a comedy show stuffed with funny voices and catchphrases while forbidding them from doing funny voices and catchphrases. That's the thing, Pierre. There's a sort of an unspoken rule that people doing Blue Bottle and Eccles is strictly verboten on here. Okay.
That's fair enough. Not even Blood Knock.
Oh, well, look, can you do Blood Knock?
Oh God, I'll think about it.
All right, okay, all right. As you can hear, my guest this week, I've already named him. It is stand-up writer and co-host of what I would call, I suppose, the Thinking Person's podcast, Bud Pod. It's Pierre Novelli.
Hello,
Pierre. Thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Anyone listening to this show for the first time, so perhaps drawn to it due to the presence of Pierre, and why not? Maybe you may be forgiven for thinking that it's just a podcast about the Goons, which to anyone under the age of 40 with maybe only a passive interest in British comedy, the Goons might mean nothing. But, you know, they may likely have heard of Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers, and yes, it does tend to focus on Sellers and Milligan a lot, but what I like to do with this podcast is to open it up and talk about comedy in general. So that's, you know, the good comedy, the bad comedy, and Hilda Baker as well, quite often. So yeah, so I'm keen to talk to Pierre, not just about his affection for the Goons, but also, you know, his wider comedy influences. So am I right in thinking that you've recently completed a tour with your podcast co-host Phil Wang?
Yes, I was doing a section of support for him. And then, so basically my year has been tour support for Phil Wang in the spring, do some recordings and performances of my show, Why Can't I Just Enjoy Things, then do a new show at the Fringe, and then autumn tour the old show again.
Okay, so in the autumn, so what show is it in the autumn, Why Can't I Just Enjoy Things?
Yes, yeah, so that's what I'll be taking around the place, all over the UK and Dublin. So it's a bit odd to have to sort of, there's like an 8-week interlude where I'm working on a new different show and then back to the old classics from my Soho run January, February, but there you are.
Brilliant. Okay. Okay. And during our little sort of preamble before I press record, you touched on something and I just want to bring this up now because I'm a little bit older than you, Pierre. I've been looking on Wikipedia, you know, and FWIW, it's quicker to say for what it's worth, just bringing myself into this, possibly one of the biggest, if not the biggest turning point in my life, okay? My life changed irrevocably in the last week of January 1991.
All right.
Okay. And I believe that was the beginning of your life that week, was that right?
I was born January 91, yes.
Okay. No, because that's when I left New Zealand, which is where I was born and brought up, and I flew to Belfast to live, and sort of completed my schooling over there. And that was And that was really my introduction to the UK when I was 16. And I've, with a brief year going back, I've lived in the UK ever since. And my life completely changed. And it was such a... When you're someone from outside of the UK, but who kind of... I guess you're the same. You feel you're partly British because of... It's your family's heritage.
Oh, yeah.
And then you actually come here and you're in this kind of weird... middle ground where you're sort of absorbing the culture in a detached fashion, would you say?
Yeah, you're sort of halfway there but halfway not. They've got a category for you that's not the same if you were from even from the USA. It would be different. You're seen as sort of family, but extended family. You're like my cousin, because you're sort of, you know, Anglophone, white, empire vibes, but also, yeah, you're still different and we still don't like you at sport, so,
Yeah, it's family that you only really want to see at Christmas.
Yeah.
Not even then, yeah. Because you were born in Johannesburg.
Yes.
And I believe you moved to the Isle of Man when you were, what, 6, 7?
Yeah, just before I turned 7, so sort of birthday quite soon on arrival. I don't know how you found the sudden reversal of the seasons, but I had a summer birthday in South Africa and then a depths of winter birthday in the UK. Yeah,
that's right, because it was middle of summer, January 91, got on a plane in Christchurch, arrived eventually in Belfast, and it was snowing. It was eyes on stalks, basically.
Yes, exactly. And I think what's often strange, if you are an Anglophone white colonial, for want of some sort of better term, is that you are foreign to the UK more than you imagined when you weren't there. So in South Africa, if you speak English and are white, even if you have a name as European as mine, you know, Pierre Novelli, you are referred to as an Englishman. And you would describe yourself as an Englishman, and you're not, but you sort of are. And you, all your reference points for Britain or England or whatever, they're accurate, they are true, but they're woefully out of date. They're very old-fashioned.
Oh, yeah.
You've got, like, well, William books or whatever in your mind, and everyone's like, well, you watch Teletubbies? What the fuck are you talking about?
Well, that's it, because in Christchurch, which is the biggest big city to where I grew up, people used to say it's like England, but 30 years ago.
Yeah, kind of thing,
you know.
And yours would have been a more clear time travel analog, because obviously South Africa is so mixed up with different languages and cultures that, I mean, parts of the English that I spoke were loanwords from Afrikaans, a couple from Zulu even.
Oh, wow, God.
Where you just sort of go, oh, is that not slang for that here? And even your English is out of date. I mean, when I moved in the late 90s, and I was a little kid, I didn't realize in the UK, where they call it a utility room, you know, the washing machine and stuff.
Yes.
I was saying scullery.
Right.
That's the word for it in South Africa. So people were like, scullery? This Downton Abbey vocabulary for a suburban home. Very strange.
Yeah, yeah. And what about your accent? Because mine, I was considered, where I grew up, which was a small town, I was considered posh.
Yeah.
I was considered the posh kid because my mother brought me up to talk relatively properly, you know?
Yes.
And as since I've been living over here 30 plus years, my accent has changed, definitely become more, I guess, British. The more abrasive edges have been chiseled off. What about your accent? Because you don't sound... I can hear it, but, you know, I don't want to sound offensive, but the South African accent gets a bit of a bad press for being a bit quite coarse and grating,
well,
really.
Well, this is the thing, is that often when people say, like, oh, he's got a strong accent, what they mean is he's Afrikaans. And
right.
That's not even the same ethnic group as me. So it's a bit like someone going, you know, sort of talking about a Scottish person and saying, oh, his English accent's really strong, not like yours. And he sort of goes, well,
okay,
it's not the same,
right.
You know.
Right,
so people don't really know, they can't hear the difference. Whereas I could tell you, my question I ask British people when they say that is, they say, oh, I've got a South African friend at work or whatever, and he's got a really strong accent, not like yours. And I say, okay, well, does he roll his R's? And if they say yes, I go, right, he's Afrikaans. That's why.
Yeah.
That's my little test. So I've had to develop that. It mine changes. I mean, sometimes there's not even a trace of it, and people can't tell at all, at least so they say. And sometimes, sorry, they're testing some sort of fire alarm in my building, just in case.
Okay, let's hope it is a test.
Yeah. Oh, well, this is the way I want to go. And sometimes people say, oh, it's so strong and da-da-da. But it changes. I mean, because we're speaking now, it'll be much less than if I speak to my parents or to my cousins, or if I go back. I mean, it comes roaring back, full strength. I don't know if you find that with other Kiwis.
Yeah, I was back in January, actually. And I don't go back very often. I had to go back for a funeral.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
It was expected. Because I always sort of, as I say, I kind of compared to my siblings and whatnot, I had my accent was always a bit, or the way I spoke was always a bit highfalutin. Yes. You know what I mean? But funny enough, when I went to Belfast, so I was 16 and I went to this school, this new school, and it was very early 90s. So Australian soaps were all the rage. And I thought, I could use this to my advantage because they don't know the difference between Australian accents and Kiwi accents.
Yeah, of course.
So I, for a time, I was putting it about to mainly stupid girls that I had been the actor, the original actor that played Hayden in Home and Away, the one that got sacked in the first 2 weeks.
Yeah, no way to check either.
No way to check, no internet. Yeah, and the accent just, you know, to them, the accent just sounds the same.
Yeah, so, why not? I mean, I got accused of being posh. I had a thick Isle of Man accent for about 3 or 4 years.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, really, really serious one. I was accused of being posh a lot because obviously in South Africa we have long A's, you know, castle and grass. Mm. But in the UK, especially up north, northern England, which the Isle of Man culturally is, that's very highfalutin. That's very posh to say castle and grass instead of castle and grass.
Yes, yes.
So they they weren't too pleased about that. Whereas I didn't know what posh really meant, because class in the UK, you know, we could talk for 1,000 years about class, but it's not just money. Or Wayne Rooney would be posh, and he's not. Yeah, he's got plenty of money.
That's
it's
right.
All sorts of other secret rules, hidden things, yeah.
Your name. So yeah. It's French-Italian,
that's
basically.
Right, yeah.
How did that come about? How's that all?
On my dad's side, the Italian part moved to South Africa in the late 1800s, I think. They moved en masse with another family. Presumably Italy was in chaos at that point. Who knows? But so they moved. So that's the Italian sort of paternal line thing. And then the French name, my grandmother was Afrikaans, and there's a lot of French names in South Africa. Because the Afrikaners are essentially a mixture of the Dutch people from the 1600s, but a lot of Low Countries, French Protestants, the Huguenots from France.
Mm.
And that's why like the South African sports teams have always got, you know, François Duplessis and André so-and-so and a few Pierres in there as well. So it's quite common.
Okay. I had Ben van der Velde on last year.
Oh, yes.
Do you know Ben? And he said to me, oh, you know, you should get Pierre on, and he said that one of the things that sticks in his mind about you is that you used to say that whenever you saw a UKIP, or I suppose latterly a Brexit party slogan or campaign or party political broadcast, you always imagined Minnie Bannister crying, "We'll all be murdered in our beds."
Yes, that's exactly right. I tweeted that once and only about 4 people got it, but they really got it.
Well, I suppose the modern day equivalent of that is Helen Lovejoy from The Simpsons.
Yes. Think of the children.
Won't anyone think of the children? Yeah.
The powers that be have decided to actually increase the size of fishermen's meshes, thereby reducing their income by 40%. That's what you do here. That's why we're going.
Grazie,
news
conclude.
And long. We're gay and
we'll all be murdered in our beds.
I've had, as I said, Ben van der Velde, who was a guest on the show, he obviously highlighted to me that you were quite keen on the Goons.
Oh, yeah.
And a couple of months ago, and I must have been, I don't know whether you were interviewed on something, or I had a spate of people messaging me, you know, listeners to the show, saying, why don't you get Pete, try and get Pierre Navalli on?
Yeah, I mentioned the goons on something. I can't remember.
Oh, okay.
I always mention them whenever there's the inevitable question about influences or first comedy or something like that.
Yeah.
So they're always popping up in what I churn out for publicity.
See, it's fair to say most of my guests, because I'm still in my 40s, just, okay. most of my guests are around my sort of age, so people in the 40s, late 30s, 40s, 50s, you know. And most of them were too young to have heard the Goons first time round, but they got into it through parents, through the dad usually, you know. And I'm just wondering, you know, was it your dad? Was it your mum even? How did you discover the Goons?
So when we moved to the Isle of Man, I sort of, maybe I actually ended up turning 7 before I started school. But in South Africa, you start school when the year you turn 7. So I'd never been to school, but I was coming in 3 years late to the British system.
Right.
So I had to get pretty keen on the library, and I did. And the first book I read from the Port Erin tiny local library on the Isle of Man was a horrible histories book about dark knights and dingy castles. That's what it was called. And so this library was very old school, small sort of village library. And at some point, I sort of came to the attention of the librarian when I was there with my mum. And I was looking at some cassette tapes, which is how early 90s the library story is.
Yeah.
And they have this kind of shelves of cassette tapes you could take out. And the librarian said, oh, all of those are the Goons. My husband loved them when he was a kid. And I remember that interaction. And I remember that was when I took them out of the library. I'd get these Goon cassettes by coincidence. And I don't think my dad had mentioned it, but my dad and his brother would listen to the Goons when they were young in South Africa. They would listen to the international edits on the World Service.
Sure.
Which were removed. They removed all the topical stuff because it would have just been gibberish.
Yeah, well, they removed topical stuff, and also later on, because there were, I won't bore you with the details, but there was a second set of edits, if you like, if you want, in the 60s, where they removed a lot of racially insensitive stuff.
Yeah,
as well.
I think that must have been what the ones they were hearing, especially if that was early to mid 60s. But yeah, so I came home and my dad knew what they were all about, and my uncle Alan as well, my mum's stepbrother, he was a huge fan of the Goons. So whenever I saw him, I would torture him by talking to him about the Goons as a weird little 9-year-old or whatever.
Yeah,
but I just got obsessed, and I definitely listened to everything that the cassettes in the library had to offer.
Was this the first comedy you were really exposed to then?
I was sort of aware of comedy through TV in the sense of like The Simpsons or like sort of sitcom-y kind of kid stuff.
Right.
And my dad, I don't know if my dad at that point had introduced me to the Pink Panther, so I sort of knew who Peter Sellers was, or I would have found out through the Pink Panther quite soon after. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
mm-hmm.
definitely the first comedy that I discovered on my own or felt like I had some ownership over.
And what was it about? Can you remember? Was it just the funny voices? Was it, I mean, you can't say it was the tightly plotted storylines, but what was it about? What was it about it that sort of caught your imagination?
The silly voices obviously were great. And also just the fact that like, a lot of the comedy in The Goons is quite Looney Tunes. I mean, you don't have to be too old to understand the fact that it's very silly that, you know, the telephone sounds like bagpipes or there can't be anyone at the door because you just let them in. You know, the absurdism of it is very, very, very digestible for kids, more so than some sort of like highfalutin satirical show might be.
Sure.
But I just got upset. I mean, I listened to those things till they wore out. Yeah.
And can you remember the first one you heard, first show you heard?
I think it was Napoleon's Piano.
I was looking for a man who might specialize in piano robberies from the Louvre.
Good evening.
You are looking for a man who might specialize in piano robberies from the Louvre?
How do you know?
I was listening on the radio and I heard you say it.
Good, sit down.
No, thank you, I'm naked.
Garcon? Two glasses of English port type cooking sherry. Now, have a gorilla.
No thanks, I only smoke baboons.
Good show.
Yes, baboon show. Thank you. Thank you, and now back to the plot.
Yes, this piano we must steal. It's the one Napoleon played at Waterloo.
Steal? That will be a very sticky job.
Why?
It's just been varnished.
The German joke, yeah? The English silence.
And so what, did you then go, because obviously this was from the library, these were tapes from the library.
Yeah.
And there's only a finite number of commercial releases out there. Did you go on to sort of try and, I mean, there were repeats in the 90s on Radio 4 and Radio 2, but did you do any, mind you, you really came of age in the late 90s, didn't you? So were you trying to source shows elsewhere as well and get as much stuff as you could?
I didn't quite understand that things were available in other places. And I mean, the Isle of Man is a very small place. And so I sort of very early on, not quite accurately, accepted that like, oh, you know, you take what you can sort of find locally in these small shops or whatever. So
yeah,
I sort of didn't until I was older. And to be fair, I mean, I was very computer literate from a young age, but stuff like YouTube and even a lot of the more venerable Goon Show sites, especially with regards to audio clips and stuff, they weren't really up and running till, I mean, YouTube, 2005. So there's a gap of a few years there. But once I realized, oh my God, you know, these things are on the iTunes store. So I would like buy them there.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to keep banging on about your age compared to mine, but yeah, I'm a generation older than you, so
yeah.
So it was much more analog back in my day, you know, in terms of you just had to wait for it to turn up on the radio and get your cassette tape and tape it.
Yes.
And was it like, did this then open you up to, did you then go looking for other comedy, maybe radio comedy on cassette, or did it, like Python, for example, did you seek out Python?
Oh yeah, I mean, not, I don't even know if consciously, but then yeah, massive obsession with Python, very, you know, evolution of humor naturally followed. I was always a big fan from whenever I first came across him somehow of Eddie Izzard, who also is a big Goon Show nut. And actually, you know, and that's another contender for early first listeners, Phantom Batter Pudding Hurler of Bexilonsi.
Oh, of course. Right. Okay.
Because Izzard grew up in Bexilonsi a bit.
Yes, he did.
Yes. So, yeah, Monty Python and then Izzard and then just generally becoming a lot more aware of stand-up at that point. All the sketch shows that were on TV, and this is the noughties we're talking about in the UK, so that was the boom time for sketch shows. Mitchell and Webb, Armstrong and Miller, and then you got Peep Show, blah, 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 blah. All the great stuff. And then just getting really into stand-up through sort of satellite TV and now YouTube really coming to the fore in terms of finding clips of stuff, yeah.
Good heavens, Private Eccles!
Yeah!
Damn Eccles, I'm...
Yeah, you told me the waiter until you came back, remember?
Oh, yes. Oh, horror of horrors.
Oh, me?
Dear faithful old hairy English Tommy. 10 years you've waited here, rather than disobey that last order I gave you. Stay here till I came back, I said to him. He waited alone in the desert. He never wavered from his duty. He kept the name of servitude shining bright. Eccles, you upheld the flag. You never questioned the order. You stayed out here alone. You without food or water. You without money. You without anything to stop you walking away. You idiot!
What? Me an idiot? Let me put this violin down, I'll tell you.
What interests me about the Goons is that every single person involved in the Goon Show was ex-military or World War II veteran to some degree.
Yeah.
And the thing you find, especially in humor from as close to the war as possible, is that it is completely acceptable to make fun of the idea of Major Bloodnock as an avaricious, egotistical coward, and all the sort of privates not wanting to get out of bed and do things, and they may be feeling a bit lazy, or they don't want to, you know, people getting blown up and stuff. It's all completely acceptable, because it was all not just real to these guys, but these guys were conscripted, so they didn't want to be there. And when I was growing up, a lot of, you know, I mean, because of the law in South Africa under apartheid, there was conscription. And, you know, if you didn't just go along and suffer for 9 months doing jumping jacks in the bush, they'd stick you in jail for a few years and ruin your life. So people just did it, whether they wanted to or not. And so I grew up around, you know, family, friends, my dad, a lot of people who'd had to do military service who didn't want to. And they had lots of jokes that were very similar. And what I find now is that the more and more your military becomes volunteers and so forth, we're getting slightly American in that kind of, you know, the military is sacred and God forbid anyone should tell any funny jokes about it kind of territory. But the irony is that I've got friends in the military who are ex-military, and they tell all the same jokes, but it's sort of panicked civilians who are desperate to level this kind of, to my mind, very American sort of sacral respect on our brave boys and so on. And look, there's an element of that is true and is necessary and is good, but I think that's something that's so interesting about the goons, is that you could never... It would be a lot harder to do jokes about the military in that way now. Partially because we're slightly getting a bit American and sacred about it, but also partially because, look, the public have no idea what a drill sergeant is. They don't know anymore.
That's very true,
and
yeah.
I mean, even, you know, some mothers do... No, it ain't half hot, mum.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the drill sergeant sort of character in that, that only worked because 50% of the population, all the men, at some point had been bullied by a guy who looked and sounded like that.
Absolutely right. Well, that's it. Because if you look in the 50s, into the 60s, and into the 70s, as with It Ain't Half Hot Mum, British films and British TV, it was full of military-based comedy.
Yeah, and the Monty Python as well, just the army sketches.
Well, yeah. So in the 60s, in the 50s, you've got Carry On Sergeant, which is the first Carry On film. You've got The Army Game, which is one of ITV's first sitcoms. And yeah, Python, you know, Graham Chapman dressed up as a general coming on and saying, come on, this has become too silly.
Now, what do you want?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not prepared to pursue my line of inquiry any further, as I think this is getting too silly.
Quite agree. Silly. Right, get on with it.
The camp drill sketch where they're all doing very sort of camp theatrical drill.
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, so much of it was because, like you say, people grew up or people, you know, men of that generation had served and knew. And if they hadn't served during the war, they'd done national service until it was abolished.
Yeah.
And I had a guest on the writer Christopher Douglas last year, and he made an observation which I thought was very, very interesting about 50s British comedy, or British comedy in the 50s. He said it was that generation of comics. It was the only decade in British comedy that didn't really have officer class comedy.
Yeah,
I don't want to sound embarrass you or anything, but were you vice president of Footlights or president of Footlights at Cambridge?
I was vice, yeah.
Vice, okay. But yeah, obviously, if we get into the 60s, late 50s, into the 60s, you've got Cook and Moore and Bennett and Jonathan Miller, and then, of course, Python and subsequently Not the 9 o'clock News and all that sort of, you know, the Oxbridge comedy that kind of dominates British comedy for, well, it still, do you think it still does to this day? Or is it really sort of, no?
No, you're treated like a bit of a weird relic if people find out you've done it.
Right.
There's some people still around. The last big hurrah for sort of Oxbridge-y style comedian? I don't know. I mean, Simon Bird in Between Us?
Mitchell and Webb, but they're...
Mitchell and Webb, they're sort of mid-90s graduates. Simon Bird a bit later. And these days, if you see anyone who went through Footlights, it'll be because they're a stand-up like Phil Wang or Ahir Shah, and they're sort of not what you'd expect from Oxbridge, in the sense that they're non-white, or they're from a more working class or lower middle class background, state educated like Ahir. And people are often surprised to learn that those guys are Oxbridge, because in our heads it's just Stephen Fry being churned out like a robot like thousands of times.
I suppose in the 80s you had the more red brick university, like the Rick Mayles and Ben Eltons and whatnot. But do you think it's cyclical? Do you think that the Oxbridge comedians will rise again, or is that dead now?
I think it will be cyclical in the sense that Cambridge, even since I was there, has massively upped its proportion of state school students. And generally, to be honest, the kind of kids who go there who are attracted to comedy, especially these days, they don't tend to be the sort of, Sir Bufton Tufton types as much as you'd think. The ones who sound poshest tend to be the guys who you find out are the sons or grandsons or daughters or granddaughters of like proper sort of 70s loveys, from London. So they're posh in the sense that they're kind of artistic establishment, but they're not posh in the sense of owning, land or horses or something. They're posh in the way that they are connected, but they tend to have parents who spent all their money on tantric dreaming courses in the 80s or something, So it's quite a mix. I think it'll come back purely because slowly but surely Oxbridge is becoming very representative, or much more representative. It's going to take a while, but at the pace they're going, in 15, 20 years, there'll be some massive resurgence.
Yeah, I don't know. So when did you decide that you wanted to take on comedy as a career?
I was talking to a guy who used to be a member of a sketch act called The Pen, who they are a rare example of a slightly more stereotypical Footlight success from recently. They're a sketch double act now. They've been sort of Radio 4 series. They did a West End run, sort of very classic, silly sketches. Anyway, there used to be a trio, and I was talking to one of them in second year, and he said the nice thing about the student gigs at Cambridge was that we had professional comedians would come and host them, because we would, the student bars would offer them, gig level money, 100, 150 quid, and it would be a young audience. And so I met, when I was still a student, I met, Nish Kumar, Ed Gamble, James Acaster, who, now that's a very famous list of people, but back then it was just some guy. But they would tell me this is our job. We do this. You can get money like this, and this is how you do it, and blah blah blah. And I was saying to this guy, I might give that a go actually. And he said, well, obviously. And he said it with such contempt, like it was such an obvious thing to say, like I'd said something stupid. That I went, oh, that's actually quite a vote of confidence, isn't it? And annoyingly, in my stand-up, I sometimes use quite weird imagery and languages and stuff, and I'm getting a bit weirder as I get older, but because my stand-up had to pass muster in, nightclubs or working men's clubs or comedy clubs or whatever, I always felt like I couldn't go too strange, and you don't see as much of that vein of humor that was so influential on me in my a lot of my output.
Yeah.
I did do a lot of sketch shows. I've done maybe 4 or 5 hour-long sketch shows. One of them was the Footlights tour show, and whenever I wrote sketches, the goon side would come out a lot more with sort of surrealism or physical absurdism, or just general silliness. And I brought a bit of that in, I think, when I was a writer for Spitting Image, the recent revival.
Oh, right. Yes. Yes.
And so when I was writing sketches for that, I tried to bring in a bit of that silliness with... I pitched some sketch. It didn't get made, but it was back when the Pope was getting all these ridiculous reassurances from Xi Jinping about Christians in China being treated very nicely and religious minorities generally being treated nicely in China.
Yeah.
And it was, I read the sketch, the Pope went to Xi Jinping's, you know, Chinese medicine sort of parlor for these like fake treatments that aren't real kind of thing, like that being the angle.
Yeah.
And I sort of worked in a lot of silly sort of body humor there. I think I was too detailed a pitch. It's a lot easier just to do a sketch where The Rock has a fight with Billie Eilish or something, I think. More appealing.
Yeah, I had... Were you involved? Because I had Al Murray on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The show. And he wrote some stuff for Spinning Image, of course. And he was writing... I think it's on now for a live Spinning Image show.
Yes,
were you involved with that?
West End? No. That's above my pay grade. I was one of the... The faceless legion sort of levels of writing for the TV show. It's writer's room stuff. Al was in the upper echelon. He was in the officer's mess, I think. It was on in Birmingham for a bit to knock it together. And then it's on in the West End now. And obviously, all sympathy for them because they have to keep updating it because things keep happening to Boris Johnson.
Oh, God. Every week. Yeah. It seems like that's a week ago, it was all over the news. It seems like it's completely forgotten now.
Yeah.
It?
Yeah. It's
at the time of recording, I mean, we've had this terrible tragedy with the submarine.
Yes.
But that's taken up the column inches. But yeah, the news it's just 24-hour rolling news is both a blessing and a curse, I think, in modern society.
Yeah. Yeah, and it makes topical writing easier and harder because things can be shockingly relevant, but they like fruit in hot weather, they go off sooner.
Yes, yeah. And getting back to the Goon Show, I mean, that was what people forget. And you mentioned it yourself because your dad and your uncle would listen to it, but it was edited, so all the topical stuff was taken out. And... So, because I started this podcast a couple of years ago, and you know, we're very lucky now in 2023 that we have access. I say we, you know, Goon fans have access to pretty much pristine, restored shows with all the edited stuff put back in. And so I'm slowly working my way through the shows and listening to stuff that I hadn't heard, you know, when I listened to the edited shows when I was much younger. So you know, lots of references to topical, you know, things that were in the news in the 50s. And Milligan, in some ways, was a, you know, you could make an argument that he was one of the biggest satirists of the 50s, just in terms of particularly satirizing things like, you know, the 1984 television broadcast, which 3 weeks after that was shown on BBC television, the Goons did a parody of that.
Yeah.
And there were lots of references to politics that were removed. You know, specific references to Churchill, Attlee.
Yes, the phantom head shaver, they had a Churchill and Attlee joke.
Yeah, that's right, absolutely. And very often these were removed. It's for me, sometimes the most interesting thing about listening to these restored Goon shows is the stuff that's been put back in, even if I don't understand the context.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, when they did the Phantom Batter Pudding Hurler of Bexhill-on-Sea, there's some line, and it was, who would be walking a gas oven along cliffs at this time of night, or some question like that. And I think Henry Crun suggests, he goes, Lady Docker? You know?
Yeah.
And I had to look up Lady Docker, Nora Docker, and she is this sort of scandalous socialite.
Yeah, that's right.
And as a comic hearing that joke, I mean, the audience lose their minds for it. It gets that really sharp crack of laughter that you know when you've really hit. And so I thought, well, it must be good, whoever Lady Docker is. Just listen to them.
Yeah, references to people like Mortimer Wheeler and... Oh, what was his name? The rudest man in Britain. I can't think of his name now.
Oh,
it's going to bug me. Listeners will know who I'm talking about. But yeah, references to people like that, which slayed the audience of the day.
And oh God, who is it? Sabrina.
Oh, Sabrina.
Yes. Yeah. I had no idea who that was when I was a kid. And I imagine my surprise as an adult where I finally think, well, who is that? And it's sort of a busty glamour model. I had no idea.
Well, yeah, but it's kind of like, I don't know how to say this discreetly, kind of like two traffic cones under a jumper, isn't it? Really, yeah. It's really weird.
Yeah, but just the idea that the whole time as a kid I was listening to, like, oh God, what's his name? It's Hercules, Gritpipe Thin, and...
Moriarty.
Yeah, Moriarty. When he's, you know, great Sabrina's protruders or whatever. I was just like...
Oh, Sabrina's Measurements.
Yeah, Sapristi Nocco, Sabrina's Measurements, yeah.
Yeah.
I had no idea what the hell they were on about. I was just happy that it was funny gibberish.
Sapristi Measurements! It's Sabrina!
Wrong! It's me with my arms folded! Sigun's the name?
Sigun? Oh, it can't be! You're a lying charlatan!
Rubbish, I'm a truthful charlatan!
Gilbert Harding, that's who I was thinking of.
Oh, yes.
Someone that, one of those people that was all over everything in the 50s and completely forgotten today.
But now, the thing with the references, this is the thing that really bugs me in modern comedy as a writer, is that these days, and I think it's because, to be fair to them, producers and people who make shows, everyone's freelance now. Nothing's really done in-house, so no one is secure. So they're all terrified of losing their completely temporary contract. And, you know, fair enough. But all of these references that I was listening to that I didn't necessarily get, I still learned from them. They still made me smarter. And the same with The Simpsons referencing George H.W. Bush or the Nixon and the Futurama or whatever. It's how you learn. You understand the world through comedy that you don't understand because you know it's funny. You can hear it getting a laugh. So you think, well, I'll find out about that.
Absolutely.
It's such a gateway.
It is. It makes you actually go out and again, in my day, go to the library or now go on, just Google it.
Just ask someone and be part of the world. Whereas now, a lot of, not all, but a lot of producers, a lot of people involved in this stuff have an imaginary idiot in their head that they use to edit with. And they sort of go, well, I've imagined a very, very stupid person and they don't get that. So we can't do it. And you think, wow. Is that really the best way to produce good stuff? I mean, it's helpful if you're trying to make something that is accessible to everyone, and there's a place for that, but I don't think you can hit the same artistic heights without some standards.
Yeah, no, nobody, you can't make a reference to Rashomon, because you know, an 18-year-old in Leicester won't know what Rashomon is.
Yeah, and so. I only know what Rashomon is because of The Simpsons.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's one of the last jokes I laughed at in The Simpsons because it was quite late period Simpsons that. This is a question I always ask guests about the Goons. Okay, so when you're listening to the shows, and we get the Ray Ellington and the Max Galdray numbers.
Yeah.
Did you listen to those or did you skip? Did you fast forward?
As a kid, unless they particularly something about them got me. Like Old Man, the way he sings Old Man River in one is quite energetic and fun. I would fast forward as a kid, but as an adult, when I was older, I would listen to them because they themselves were quite interesting. And by that point, when I was a bit older, I'd gotten a lot more into jazz and blues. Mm. And so I sort of thought, wow, imagine that. And in fact, from my Footlights year, Phil Wang, Jason Forbes, and George Fouracres, they were a sketch trio called Daphne. And they made two series of a radio comedy for Radio 4 called Daphne Sounds Expensive. And because Jason is Forbes, who you could get on this, who's also a big fan of the Goons, they had an announcer like Greenslade with a booming voice. And they had some live band involved.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a direct reference to the Goons. Yeah, so it's still happening a bit.
Yeah, well, I always think, because, I used to skip very often, but sometimes I'd like whatever song it was, but you think now, you know, people like Keith Moon, John Lennon, they were teenagers listening to this as it went out, you know, show some respect. listen to it.
Yeah.
I've always had a bit of an issue with the. So whenever there's a documentary about whoever it may be, Milligan generally, or the goons, and they want to show a clip or play a clip of the Goon Show, they always tend to play the same clip, which is the What Time Is It Eccles
yes.
clip. And I really tire of that. I think that's hackneyed. That's hoary, you know. I don't want to sort of put you on the spot here, but is there a sequence, not necessarily Blue Bottle and Eccles, but is there a sequence that is really dear to your heart that you think would make a great example to, if you wanted a 2 or 3 minute little clip to play to someone to sort of illustrate the goons, is there something Ooh. Is there a clip that you would suggest?
Let me see. I'm a big fan of of Major Bloodnock. I find him really funny. But I guess it's quite contextual, isn't it?
Well, very often with him, the whenever he's introduced, he has his own theme tune for a start, his own intro music.
Yes.
And then you usually get about 30 seconds of explosions to denote flatulism. Flatulence.
I never knew that that was even supposed to be farting when I was a kid. I just thought, oh, I guess he's in the military, so he's sort of pursued by explosions in some way. Yeah, and him sort of going, oh, just horrified by his own farts, yeah.
I can't go to parties anymore. Oh. Oh, yes?
Bloodnock, this is the insurance company. It's no good, sir. We've got to increase the premium on your underwear.
Oh, dear.
What was that Goon Show one? Was it the mummified priest, or where they try and find the tomb of Genghis Khan?
That's the Lost Emperor.
Oh, that's right. There's definitely a bit in that. I would play people just like a montage of the little jokes. Like, I'm just looking it up here. So in The Last Emperor, just lines like Moriarty saying, "I'll give you something to make you talk. Take that." And it Seguin says, "A pound note. I'm English. Yes. Money won't make me talk. I'll just point." And I love that how consistently they have jokes about, you know, the honor of the English, and then just easily bribed.
Well, that's an interesting show as well, because Spike was always pushing and pushing to get as much into the show that he could that would be under the radar of the censors.
Yes.
You know what I mean? The BBC censors. Because so that, you know, the everyone knows that they had a character called Hugh Jampton, which was rhyming slang, and you know, even things like Bloodnock's, you know, farts and all the rest of it, but there's a few Goon shows where it's alluded to that Gritpipe Thin is gay.
Oh, interesting. Yes, his sort of oily voice.
Yeah. I think it's in the Goon Show scripts book that was obviously written in the 70s that Milligan makes it clear that Gritpipe is gay. But obviously in the 50s, you couldn't be quite so blunt. And but in the Lost Emperor show, there's a bit where Eccles is guarding Gritpipe and Moriarty, and he's got them, he's pointing a gun at them.
A crowded room, and a from home.
Do you know any more like this?
Yeah, here's one. Oh, a crowded room.
Eccles, not quite right. You see, to get the right feeling, you must close your eyes.
I'm no fool. If I close my eyes, I won't be able to see you.
Will you miss me?
Oh, here.
Yes, I remember that. I remember really loving that. A really sort of intense mouth against the ear.
Yeah.
I mean, I was amazed. Actually, I've just remembered another reference where it might be the episode where they finally coin and distribute the term lurgy, and they're in Parliament or some episode where the joke is that Parliament is full of sort of useless old duffers.
Yeah.
And they're sort of and like coughing and stuff. And then someone makes some very slow, belabored point that's very obvious. And then one of them shouts as a sort of MP in the background, "What about our boys at Mafeking?" Which is a Boer War reference.
Yes.
Which is the most astonishingly niche, certainly these days, reference to make.
Well, because Milligan was born in India. Of course, India's not South Africa, but he was born in, you know, the height of empire.
Yeah.
And grew up reading these boys' own stories and,
well, and I mean,
hearing all this.
Yeah, the only reason that I can do jokes about South Africa or being South African or anything in the UK is because, to a lesser extent, but still to a massive degree, the British public have a relatively high level of knowledge, high level of interest in former colonies. Whereas I could not do stand-up about South Africa or notions or stereotypes or thoughts about South Africa in America or even Canada. They just don't know anything. They just, as far as they're concerned, you might as well just be from Mozambique or Peru. They've got no frame of reference for you whatsoever. They don't know any. They have no expectations. If you're lucky, they've seen Blood Diamond.
So, would you say that you're a glass half empty kind of person in terms of you? I'm not saying you're a misanthrope, but are you generally looking at the seamy underbelly of life rather than looking for the positives?
I'm quite a dissatisfied person, but I think that that's crucial if you're going to keep creating, because the second that you're satisfied, I think then you sort of go, oh, well, I've done it now. So I think I really, really enjoy some very specific things or under certain conditions. But by and large, yeah, I'm a bit dissatisfied. But I think it's better to enjoy things aware of the dissatisfying elements rather than to ignore or discount them and enjoy them under a sort of false flag.
Mm-hmm, sure.
It feels more meaningful.
So when people are coming to see you, you know, in your next tour with Why Can't I Just Enjoy Things?
Yeah.
What are they going to be expecting to see? What are they going to see?
I would say if I'm grumpy or misanthropic, it's only in a sort of John Cleese, Fawlty Towers-y sort of way. A frustrated man trying to do his best as opposed to a negative man. Mm-hmm. They'll see some stuff they agree with, and at the end of the show I answer the question. So if that's of interest, then they'll get an answer.
So, do you guys know the phrase, "It's always the quiet ones"? Good phrase, yeah, useful phrase. So let's say you have two colleagues, Alan and Susan. Susan and Alan. So, you have two colleagues, Susan and Alan. Let's say you go into work one day, and someone says to you, "Did you hear about Susan? Oh, it's always the quiet ones. What that means is Susan's a bit sexy. Susan got off with someone at the Christmas party. Susan went home with someone at a nightclub when everyone went out afterwards. Someone found Susan on a swingers website. Susan's a bit of a dark horse, it turns out. Hey, did you hear about Susan? Oh, it's always the quiet ones. Alan. You come into work and someone says, did you hear about Alan? Oh, it's always the quiet ones. Alan killed Susan. There are helicopters above his garden. They're digging it up. It's bad.
You've been doing Bud Pod for how long now, the podcast? How long have you been doing that?
3 and a bit years, I think, yeah.
Okay. And has it built up sort of like, have you got like a hardcore of regular listeners?
Oh, yes, there's an elite legion, yeah. Mm. A Praetorian Guard, absolutely. For which I'm very grateful. And I'm very pleased that because Bud Pod is something that me and Phil do without any real artifice, the people who end up really liking it are very sort of almost by definition end up being people who we quite like when we meet them, which is very nice. It's very not all comedians like their fans. So
name some of them.
never.
I've listened to quite a lot of Bud Pod. I haven't listened to them all, but I have listened to quite a lot, and you regularly dropping in references to Milligan and the Goons.
Oh, really? I haven't even done that consciously, am I?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah, I mean, I think the little sketches that I put in sometimes are quite weird and goony sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Silly voices.
I just want to sort of begin wrapping up now. And is there anything that, you know, is there anything else about the Goons or that sort of area that you want to touch on that you haven't had a chance to mention?
I suppose it's the sort of thing where you wish, to an extent, you wish that on mainstream channels it was easier to get more innovative stuff off the ground, and sometimes it is, but as much as you can get annoyed with mainstream channels about their caution and their precarious positions, the internet, the fact that you and I are talking and making something at all is where the freedom and the interesting things are happening. So we still have it. It's just that, unfortunately, you've got to try and figure out the best way to hunt it down. So, I mean, maybe, in a way, those guys, Milligan and Sellers and Seacom and obviously...
Benteen
and my brain today, Eric Sykes and all those guys, if they were around today, maybe they would just be saying, well, screw the Radio 4 commissioner, we're doing a podcast. So yeah, I try to be optimistic in that sense and sort of think, try and find opportunities to make something that's like what got you into it in the first place.
Would you say it's democratic now? It's more democratic because of podcasts?
Podcasts certainly help. I mean, it's still never going to be fully democratic in the sense that, you know, if you're the second son of the Earl of wherever, or more accurately just, you know, the Earl of wherever very rarely has money. So it would be better to say if you're the second son of a Google CEO or something, you can just pay to promote the podcast, get lots of listeners, do this, do that, whatever, and so you
True.
Money and position can still trump the system and in ways that you can't plan for. But certainly it's democratic in the sense that you personally will not be stopped.
Yeah.
You can do it. It who knows if it'll hit or if it'll take off, but there is no structural thing in the way beyond whatever it costs to get a basic laptop microphone combo, which is still not nothing, but I mean it's the least it's ever been in human history.
And I think as well, even if you've only got 200 300 400 500 listeners who regularly listen, that's amazing.
Because
you go to a town hall and expect to, you know, stand up on stage in front of 500 people, that's an and you know, they keep coming back every week to hear you talk, that's an amazing
feet. Vickers would kill for that sort of thing. For those numbers weekly. Yeah.
Anyway, let's get off this soapbox. P. Ellison, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me to finally talk about the Goons.
Yeah, I appreciate we've not said a huge amount, but it's something that I would urge, and I'm sure you would urge anyone who's a fan of, you know, anyone listening to this who's not necessarily listened to this before and are not familiar with the Goons, Spotify, BBC Sounds, YouTube, they're all available. Please, you know, take half an hour just to listen to Napoleon's Piano or The Rent Collectors or even Batter Pudding Hurler. And it's half an hour well spent.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Pierre. Well, thank you very much. And hopefully we will talk again sometime in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you.